Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this special session of this conference on the governance of climate change. As you heard earlier this morning, today we had expected to have the Honorable John Warner, member of the United States Senate from Virginia, present for this conference. But as I explained earlier, due to pressing matters before Congress this week, especially today and tomorrow, he had to make the difficult decision yesterday to appear by video rather than in person. And fortunately, he was able to reserve the Senate studio to record answers to some highly relevant questions as he was interviewed by Barry Rabe. He was so well organized that he was able to make a quick trip to Washington yesterday to make this video possible and still keep the conference on track. And so I think you can tell that we take all of this very seriously. Let me introduce the video by introducing him as if he were here. He's a good friend of mine. He understands as well as anyone what it means to serve the public, having spent 40 years in government and military service. He has exemplified personal leadership and certainly left an indelible mark on American governance during his career in public service. He's earned a reputation as a savvy legislator whose style reflects the virtues valued in Virginia, that is, pragmatism over partisanship. Clearly, his experience as a Marine officer, sailor, and Secretary of the Navy has strongly influenced his leadership and legislative style. Now concluding 30 years in the United States Senate, this legislator is known for his unwavering support for the men and women of the armed forces. But he has also earned a lot of admiration and respect for his energetic involvement in the work of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee, among others. During the past year or so, Senator Warner's name has been closely associated with climate change legislation, better known as the Warner-Lieberman Bill. It was the subject of vigorous discussion in the Congress during this past year. Senator Warner has graciously consented to participate in this conversation about the governance of climate change strategies, and I'd ask you now to turn your attention to this graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law and the recipient of the 2008 Jefferson Medal for Citizen Leadership, which he accepted earlier this year here at the Rotunda. Senator Warner, wherever you are.
Thank you, Governor Blyles. You've been a great friend to me for many, many years, and I'm privileged to parachute in on you at noon here today, having taped this in the United States Senate studios here in Washington, D.C. I had looked forward to being at this very important conference. I commend you, Governor, and the Miller Center, Dr. Rabb, who's joined me here and came up from Charlottesville for this taping, because you're doing vitally important work for the future of our nation. Charlottesville, I'm sure you've told your guests that if I graduated from the law school, I wouldn't be a United States Senator today, now in my 30th year, had it not been for what the UVA Law School prepared me in law many years ago. And I have a grandson there now, and I hope to see him on this trip, but I'm here, ladies and gentlemen, at this conference because this is one of the important days in my 30 years, maybe one of the most important. We're gathering on the floor here and within the hour to debate this very severe problem of America's economy and the need for congressional action. And the specific purpose, of course, is the problem facing the several very major corporations in Detroit and across the nation with regard to the auto industry and the need for financial help. We're going to be voting, I think, perhaps this afternoon and again tomorrow, so please accept my apologies. But nevertheless, Dr. Rabb came up, and I'm joined by Chelsea Maxwell. Chelsea Maxwell is, I think, one of the ablest persons on the staff of the United States Senate. I'm on the Environment and Public Works Committee, and that committee, we had Chelsea Maxwell as my counsel, working with Chairman Barbara Boxer on this important legislation. So with that background, I'll now defer to you, Doctor, to lead off as you see fit.
First of all, on behalf of the Miller Center and all the people participating in the conference, thanks very much to you, to both of you, for joining us. Very happy to have you with us. We will be releasing a survey tomorrow of opinion across the United States. And among the findings are that Americans are very concerned about the issue of climate change and believe that it is both a federal and state responsibility to respond. Is this the kind of an issue where the public is taking the lead and the Congress has been lagging and slow to respond and now may be beginning to formulate a response? How would you characterize that relationship between public?
I'd like to give that background because Chelsea Maxwell and I worked through this bill. This is the Lieberman-Warner bill, 500 pages. And we on the Environment and Public Works Committee, Joe Lieberman, myself, and the chairman, recognize the need to begin to get Congress more involved. And indeed, our target was to have specific legislation in this Congress, which will expire presumably at the end of this week. We did not achieve that goal. I'll address that momentarily. But frankly, we had hoped to get the support of the administration. And I'm just stating the administration determined this legislation would not pass. And using the rules which are available here in the United States Senate, pursuant to the rules, we put the bill after 25 hearings and putting these 500 pages together with the help of industry, academia, all over America. And the governors were very active, they testified before in the course of these. It was incredible. Over 14 months we worked on this.
Yes, sir.
But the decision was made by the administration and the leadership of the Republican Party, which I am proud to be a member of. They decided not to do it, and it came to a halt. But it shows that there were some of us that wanted to make this work. I was the only Republican on the committee that voted for this bill in what we call a markup session. That's where the committee comes together and puts the final parts of the bill together. Okay, that's history. So we really ought to talk about the future, but you're correct. And in the absence of leadership from the executive branch over the years, in the absence from the leadership of the Congress, that is certainly on our side over the years, what happened? The states on their own initiatives moved in many areas and passed their own laws and put in their own regulations. And that's one of the major challenges for the president-elect. And momentarily, I went and talked to his senior staff today, and I'll read a little bit here about what his position is. So if you'd like to go to the next question, we'll move along.
I'd actually like to follow on this piece of federalism. One of the remarkable developments in this area is that over the last decade, so many states have become active, 23 states now with some variation of their own cap-and-trade bill, 28.
Excuse me, a well done, too. I'm glad they did it. It was an important set of baselines for us to try and frame our bill. And in this bill were provisions that said, we're not going to undo that, but we're going to set a floor so that nobody can push the several states below the floors they set.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that strategy? Because successor Congresses will deal with a series of states where half the states have some experience and engagement, half have not really been involved, and how one weighs that differential response within the states.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the founding fathers sort of said everything is reserved to the states except what we specifically basically put for the federal system in here. But over time, that has gone tilt somewhat the other way. I'm not able to really be definitive as exactly what solutions will be put out in the future, except that I'm very hopeful that the progress that has been achieved by the several states, 25 or so, will not be reversed, and that the future action by the federal Congress will build on what the several state legislatures have done in the past year or so.
Thank you.
But let me just read this to sort of a tone setter here. I have a great respect for President-elect Obama. I've served with him here in the Congress we became, if I may say, with modesty, good friends, and giving that he would just arrived in the Senate, he often used to find me, I was referred to as one of the old bulls, to give him a little pointer, particularly in the areas of national security. And I think he was quite interested in the course of the deliberations of our committee in our first attempt on the floor in this legislation. But here's basically what he said, and I checked it out with his senior staff this morning. He said, "Few changes facing America and the world are more urgent than combating climate change." And that's why this distinguished group have gathered here today under the auspices of the Miller Center in your leadership and that of Governor Belias. You met the first sentence of his statement. The science is beyond dispute, and the facts are clear. Sea levels are rising. Coastlines are shrinking. We've seen record droughts, spreading famine, and storms that are growing stronger with each passing hurricane season. My presidency will mark a new chapter in America's leadership on climate change that will strengthen our security and create millions of new jobs in the process. Climate change and our dependence on foreign oil, if left unaddressed, will continue to weaken our economy and threaten our national security," end quote. That's one of the reasons I got involved in this. I was chairman of the Armed Services Committee, I guess when I first started, and I could see, and in consultation with the senior members of the Department of Defense, there is very clearly a nexus between climate change and the consequences and the military roles and missions of our forces in the years to come. Most of it is a lot of the nations that have borne the brunt of these climate changes, particularly Africa and the droughts, it causes conflict between nations. That causes instability, and instability then draws the attention of not only the military forces of our country, but of other countries.
You mentioned the president-elect, and of course, one of the challenges he faces is staffing many of the agencies and departments that will be responsible for this portfolio. And the next Congress will have to think about all the different units of the federal government that could begin to play a role. What advice would you offer the president-elect or the 111th Congress in terms of thinking about the structure of government and institutions and how they may have to evolve in terms of staffing, resources, structural kinds of issues? A challenge you faced in many areas, but for which climate change poses particular problems.
Well, first, I would say with respect to my good friend, the president-elect, he doesn't need any advice. He has taken extraordinary initiatives, being very careful not to in any way tread on the constitutional system where only one president at a time. But people are in every way possible trying to join his administration. He will have nothing but the best and the brightest to draw from across this country to staff and work in the several agencies and departments on this vital subject. I mean, this is about as strong as a presidential, by president-elect that he could possibly put that statement. Now, you do put your finger on it. You get this magnificent, big, enormous federal system that he is now inheriting because of the succession of presidents who say, I remember Ronald Reagan, well, we ought to eliminate that department, eliminate this department. Well, he built government up, and every president does federal. Coordinating the several agencies is always a challenge for the president. That's the basic purpose of the president, the cabinet, to work out those different obligations of the several departments and agencies. EPA will have, Environmental Protection Agency should and will have the lead. As a matter of fact, Supreme Court said they have the authority inherent in the current body of law with regard to the regulation of CO2, which is key to so much of this. So, A, to answer your question, he'll have the best and the brightest. And B, there will be a challenge, but I've also seen elsewhere, am I not, Ms. Chelsea Maxwell, that he wants to appoint a czar?
Yes, sir. Senator-elect Obama has indicated there will be a climate czar housed on his White House staff, and presumably that person would have a coordinating role with all the agencies, defense, EPA, interior, agriculture. There are so many different facets to climate change, and every agency is going to have their finger in that pie.
Chelsea Maxwell spends all of her time generally on this subject. That's why I brought her here today. And as this Congress comes to a conclusion, you go into the private sector to work directly on these issues.
Yes, sir.
So she's right up to the tow line on all of their responses.
Just to follow up, what are your thoughts on the notion of a czar? This, of course, has been attempted in energy periodically.
Oh,
it's
yes.
being proposed in the auto industry, as you'll be discussing later today. What are your thoughts about that as a mechanism?
My good friend Governor Blyles, remember, I think Frank Zarb with his name. He was one of the first czars. And I think he worked hard. I'm not sure. That is not a fully tested and proven concept of the executive branch. But there's been mentioned there'd be an energy czar and an auto czar. And, well, I don't know. I just have to, as we say in football, punt on that. I don't know where we're going to come out. But I do know that the president-elect manifests strong leadership. And I guess if he gives someone a title of czar, he expects them to act like a czar.
Fair enough. Thank you. The bill that you've been working on fits certainly into the area of so-called cap and trade.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that struck us in the survey that will be released at the conference is that we asked Americans from across the country their reaction to a number of possible policy approaches, many of which received very strong support, bipartisan basis, actually. But when we turned to cap and trade, we found, one, that there was somewhat less support, more of a divide, and perhaps even some degree of confusion, not awareness of familiarity with what is entailed. Given the magnitude both of the climate change issue and the kinds of changes that are called for in a cap and trade bill of this sort, how does one bring the American public into that conversation and really the role of Congress in a more educational and informational sharing role, independent of the question of whether or not legislation goes forward?
I think I'll start out with a corny old story. Willie Sutton, who was a famous robber of banks, was asked one time, well, why do you rob banks? He said, that's where the money is. Well, we devised in this bill the best we could of a cap and trade system. But that system, number one, takes funds from basically industry, the industrial base, who would have to contribute, depending on their status as to their CO2 emissions, into this bank. And then it was important, once the bank was established, it wasn't robbed by the Congress to pay other bills, which Congress is prone to do now and then when they seize money, but to redirect that money back in to support the goals of the legislation, be it research and development or grants or to companies or educational institutions, all kinds of ways to implement the learning process to move forward in this complicated area. Now, I'm not presumptuous enough to say that the next Congress will lift what we had in this bill as a guidepost. They may devise their own. It's not clear. I want to get to that other section where Chairman, I talked to the chairman of the committee this morning and her senior staff, and she stated as follows. Now, I'm reading only because I want to be dead accurate. Here's the chairman of the Environment and Public Works Committee, Chairman Boxer, distinguished senator from California, with whom I've been privileged to serve and enjoy a very close working relationship over many years. She said the chairman will introduce two pieces of legislation as soon as possible in the 111th Congress. The first bill will be an economic stimulus bill, which establishes a grant program to reduce carbon emissions under the Clean Air Act, with up to $15 billion a year available to spur innovations in clean energy, including advanced biofuels. The second piece of legislation will direct EPA to set up a cap-and-trade system for greenhouse gases that meets the goals laid out by the president-elect. The bill will focus on achieving the emissions reductions needed while restoring the economy. The EPW committee will hold a hearing in January of the coming year, 09, entitled, quote, How Fighting Global Warming is Good for the Economy and Will Create Jobs, end quote. the Pew Trust, with whom I've been working on the past bill and recently discussing with them their goals, are very much involved in this. And I hope that maybe at this conference you've got some representation. But I'd like to mention up front, we all know, everyone at this conference, here in the Congress, and we're here today in a very unusual situation of what they call a lame duck session. Not one, but the second lame duck session under this Congress. Now that is a little historical footnote in itself. We're here because America is in the grips of an economic situation, the roots of such situation being really without precedent in this country. And hopefully the best minds and the partisanship, I hope, will be put aside as much as possible to help President Bush do what he can in the few weeks remaining of his administration and to lay a foundation on which President-elect Obama can then build to work out the problems of the economy. Now, I mention that because cap and trade directly affects or is related to the economy. How much can you take out of industry and transportation and manufacturing to support a cap and trade program at a time when those companies are struggling, at a time when they're laying off, unfortunately, many of them, and cutting back on their production? So I hope that the president-elect, one bit of advice that I would be presumptuous enough to give, is a provision in here, the old bill, which I worked out with Senator Lieberman. I call it, it's the engineer's seat. I think it's important that the Congress put in place the legislation that is desired to meet the challenges of the global warming situation. But give the President of the United States the throttle as to what you move forward by way of cap and trade, by way of other aspects of the bill, and what you hold until the economy, in the president's judgment, can meet this, you know, the demands that a legislative format would impose. So he has to sit in the engineer seat. And he also has to have a break, like an engineer in a train. And if he sees we're rolling too fast and the infrastructure of the manufacturing, transportation, industry, coal-fired plants can't meet it, then he has to break it down a little bit. But the important thing is all parties will know what is the intent of Congress by virtue of a piece of legislation, and the ability to move and break is left to the chief executive of our nation, the president. And that's sort of a brief summary of how I think it should be done.
So this then would be a fairly significant granting of power to the executive branch.
Yes, it would.
But not delay timetable. Related to one question that I did want to ask, there has been some discussion of stalling serious conversation of climate change because there are so many issues on the coming agenda, including the economic crisis. But you're arguing then to move forward relatively quickly with some form of legislation, but then...
As quickly as... We've got to do it thoroughly and expeditiously. I would use that word. It seems to me we have an obligation to industry, obligation to transportation, manufacturing, to say, these are our goals. This is the path by which we want to achieve it. And as you do your long-range planning, so much planning in America today, as elsewhere, has to be in the future. And they got to lay out their financial requirements for 3 and 4 years. And they have to know what are the goals and what is their role in meeting those goals, recognizing that the president will have the throttle, and they have to have their links to advise the president. But the Congress is, under this general proposal that I've just outlined, giving an unusual amount of authority to the chief executive.
Mm-hmm. You've
addressed... And then I think another thing. The president has got to pace America to some extent. I want America to lead. And I'm disappointed here in Poland we don't have any real policy, do we, Chelsea?
Coming out of Poland, no, right, sir.
And we didn't at the previous conferences. You attended the one in
Bali. There was a roadmap that came out of Bali, but yeah. The challenge with Poland is right. That there's an outgoing...
So, but America's got to be among the leaders on this. You take the principal nations of China and India. They've been followers. They're sort of watching what we do and don't do. And America can't simply go out alone on this and tax our industry and other elements and let them have a free hand. So the president has the task of making the world move together on this, because CO2 knows no bounds. Up she goes, and it's distributed over the world.
Well, and you touch upon the important international dimensions of this, even though the bill is focused primarily on domestic concerns. Mm-hmm. Our final panel is entitled Reconnecting America with the World on this issue.
And I wish I were there to listen. And I wish them luck. And I say that because that is the key to our public concern back here. And much of the concern in Congress is that we were trying to drive too hard and too far and get so far out that our industrial base would be at a disadvantage in the trade market of the products.
What are your thoughts, given the fact that our conference coincides, Poznan, and relative American disengagement? What are your thoughts about, independent of domestic legislation, how the United States begins to build partnerships, whether they're bilateral, multilateral, continental, revisiting treaty processes? How would you work the foreign policy aspects of this?
It has to be an international format. I mean, it's really a carrot and stick. You know, you've got to move along with this because we cannot put the American at a disadvantage in world trade. It all gets down. We're a global economy now. You know that as well as I do and all your conferees. And we've got to remain competitive for our own self-interest here at home. So I don't have the formulation. We put in various checks with regard to the international community. Why don't you, well, I dry my
right,
throat
and deal with that. Other industries that were not reducing their CO2 emissions to the same extent the U.S. were had to compensate. Other nations would have to compensate at the border if they were trying to bring in products. But I think that getting at the question you asked the senator, one issue that will be very big is technology transfer and making sure that some of these smaller nations that can't afford to implement or innovate on their own have access to some of the technologies that hopefully the United States will be a leader in creating and innovating. And so sharing that technology, making sure that other countries are following suit.
Thank you.
But I'd come back, Professor, and just respectfully look into the eye of all in attendance. I hope you feel the same sense of urgency that I have, and the fact that you have an opportunity under the auspices of the Miller Center to put out a report which will help guide the Congress. Your report presumably is going to be out in a timely fashion as Congress moves forward on this program.
That's the hope, yes.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you. I do realize this comes at a remarkable time in your remarkable career in the Senate, and you have faced a great many difficult policy challenges, foreign policy, the reorganization of intelligence and homeland security, domestic legislation from clean air to disabilities. How would you compare the climate change issue to some of those other issues in terms of complexity, difficulty, and even any lessons that you might be able to distill from that might help us unpack some of the ways we might move forward?
I would rank this issue at the very top of complexity, unquestionably. And the public, you detect wherever we've been in our travels on this issue, a great enthusiasm. And you've got to cap that enthusiasm and engender more enthusiasm. At the same time, you got to come up with some tough answers, be it the global trade system or how it impacts the local power plant, how it impacts the manufacturing base. And of course, that same challenge was before us, but superimposed on that challenge is now this very complex economic system that our nation is trying to work its way through.
Are there any particular, I appreciate your comment on the severe complexity, but any particular parallels with earlier policy challenges, lessons that might be drawn?
Oh, clearly the Clean Air Act was a major challenge, and the Clean Water Act, and I don't know, I was chairman of one time subcommittee on highway transportation and road building. That's where there's a great deal of politics. Fortunately, I think if you can minimize politics and just come up with good, hard, and fast bipartisan answers, you can best posture yourself.
I appreciated your comments earlier talking about some of the global dimensions and challenges, particularly facing developing countries. Can you tell us a bit about your own, the evolution of your own personal thinking on this issue? This is not an issue for which you were seen as a leader early on, but
right.
Now at this stage you are front and center. And can you just tell us about the trajectory of your thinking?
I tell you, it was two things. One, it was I realized the connection with national security and our roles and missions. And that's been my principal responsibility in my 30 years here. I've either been chairman or ranking member of the Armed Services Committee for about 15 of those years, and have dealt with militaries all over the world and traveled to a good bit of the world. But then there was a personal thing, if I may. In 1943, in the middle of the most intense periods of World War II, my father, who was an old World War I veteran, he was a doctor and was in the trenches in France, he said to me, "Young boy, you're going to get into this thing. You better get prepared, and you got to get a man's job. You got to learn how to stop riding your bike and just playing baseball." He said, "I'll pay you one way anywhere in America if you get a man's job." So I tried to outfox him, and I got a job with the U.S. Forest Service working in the forests of Idaho and Montana in 1943. Took us a week to get out there on the train in those days. And I got out there and I was thrust into those forests, and I cannot tell you how beautiful they were. No one had ever been up into some of the areas that we were in, connection with firefighting and trailblazing and road building. The trees were magnificent. The streams were pristine. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I was out in Idaho giving a speech, and I got the Forest Service to take me back. It took us hours to get up into these hills where I had once worked. Because in those days, we traveled by truck and mule train to get up there. Well, now the roads are there. But when I got into those same forests, and the trees, had, I guess some of them were there a half century ago when I was there, they're just infested with beetles, infested with disease. And I left with a broken heart to think that one of America's greatest assets, the magnificent of the spruce trees and the white pines and the whole thing, now just nature, by virtue of the imbalance in nature as a consequence of global climate change, we're losing our forests. I said, "Bingo, while you're still around, see what you can do." And that was one of the impetus of this report.
Well, that is much appreciated and respected. On behalf of Governor Belisle and all involved in the conference, I very much want to thank you for your thoughtful comments.
But I'm going to be part of this thing, you can be sure.
I have that sense, absolutely. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
and thank you, Professor. Thank you, Jerry Belisle, and the attendees for listening to this old politician. Forget about politics. I think we put a little substance on the table for a change.
Fair enough.
I want to thank Czar Warner for for his comments. You know, it would have been quite easy for him yesterday to tell us that because of the pressing business that Congress is now dealing with, that he could not participate. He insisted. He reserved the Senate studios, as you heard. But there was a limitation. He could only do it for 30 minutes. Had he been here, we were planning on about an hour and 15 minutes of discussion that would have been even more far-ranging than what you saw. But I'm very grateful to him and to Barry Rabe for the program that they have presented, and to give you some idea of Senator Warner's thinking and evolution on this subject. We could have spent this entire conference dealing with just one aspect of the program's materials. Across this country for many years, there has been a debate about the science of climate change. There have been a lot of conferences about the politics of it. Surveys have demonstrated that. As I mentioned at the beginning of this meeting, what has been not discussed very much is the governance If Congress is going to do something, if the states are going to undertake action on their own, if this country is to reconnect with the rest of the world, how shall it be done? You do not want legislative structures being put in place unless there is a basis for the policy decisions being made. That's the purpose of this conference, is to try to look at the options that this country confronts if action is taken. And in view of the survey materials released this morning, we know what the public believes. We have some indication of why they believe it. Whether we agree with that or not, it certainly is driving a lot of the political decision making in this country, both at home and around the nation. So this afternoon, we wanted to take two programs and focus on the options of a regulatory approach to dealing with climate change and then looking at market options. Those are the two programs that we'll focus on for the rest of the day. And because we have a little extra time and we need to give time for the panel, the next panel to come to the front of the room, we're going to take about a 15-minute break.